Morning, I would like to bring this medium of house, better not say fisheries. House Education Committee to order. It is 5 minutes after 8 on March 15th, and present are Representative Keller, Munoz, Wilson, Edgman, Gardner, and myself, Chair Seaton. I'd like to remind everybody, including myself, about our cell phones. And today we are going to take up House Bill 350, Public School Funding, Local Contribution. Then we will take up House Bill 413, Youth Academy Funding. And then we will take up House Bill 393, Charter Alternative School Funding. Is there anything to come before the committee before we get started? Seeing none, we have before us House Bill 350. And we have had public testimony on this bill at least twice. And we had public testimony from the, what was the associations representing the finance directors?
School administrators.
Last time at the end, I will reopen public hearing one more time for House Bill 350. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 350? Is there anyone online that would like to testify on House Bill 350? No. So I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 350, and we will go to committee discussion. And one thing that I wanted to go over for everybody's refresher and to look at things in a different way, because I know there was some, when the superintendents were here, they had some misunderstandings of what this bill actually does and why we've got it before us. So just for the public as well, I wanted to restate that the, and we've been joined by Representative Boot, that what we're looking at here is local contribution to the base basic need. Basic need component, which is what we fund under the foundation formula. And so what it does is the amount of basic need does not change. The only thing that changes is how much is required to be paid by the state and how much is going to be required to be paid under local effort. And so what we have had is the effect of this bill, and we're not saying that this was the intent when it first started, but the effect of this bill is that it is giving differential tax relief to different districts across the state, which means that we have to take money out of the school funding, the school fund, the money that we put to education, and use that for differential tax relief for municipalities. And so what this bill hopes to do is to come back so that all municipalities are treated the same, that the mill rate would be uniform, and that everyone would have a uniform starting date, so that if, as they had increases in their assessed valuation, that would be treated as at a 50% rate for 1 year, and then it would be calculated in the next year. And the problem has been that it has been just climbing extraordinarily amounts, so that now, as you see on your graphs, we're on the table, we are now at taking something like $77 million a year out of our available money for education and transferring that as tax relief to districts. Now, this is not changing at all the amount of money that a district receives. It still receives the same amount of money, but it just means that we have to take money out of the state education budget and transfer it differentially to districts. And with this continuously amounting increase, it is soon going to be that we are going to have to be limiting base student allocation increases. We're going to have to be limiting what we can do with our dollars because we're doing it. We're spending those education dollars as differential tax. And I think that that's why almost everybody across the state has come out in support of fixing this system before it gets so out of whack that it consumes a major portion of the state's education dollars. So with that reintroduction and hopefully clarification of what the bill does, I want to open up for further discussion. Representative Kell.
I'd like to balance some of the things you said. One is what you called a differential tax relief and what has been perceived as an unfair situation between districts was intended to give some coverage for the districts that are really growing. And being in the fastest growing district in the state, I'm sure you all got this graph. What we did when this passed was several years ago, the intent was to give some kind of a relief and just acknowledges the fact that there's a huge extra cost when you have lots of students. We have, I forget the exact number, but I think it's 71, I'm gonna retract that, that we have every portable that we can get our hands on in use in the MATSU. And maybe there's something that needs to be fixed, but I'll guarantee you it's not an equitable across the board difference in the tax required from the local community. It just, the burden, the way it's set up is the tax burden on landowners, you know, just goes out of sight. So the state stepped in, took, you know, take some out of GF for growing districts. Now, whether we go back and put a time on there, you know, so that when there's, when it levels out, you know, that it evens out, that may be the thing to do. But I'm gonna, you know, that's my understanding, and I sure oppose this approach.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure about how this works out in all communities, but there have been times in the communities that we've been trying to help in that way, but when the community itself voted whether to build a school or not, they voted it down. So I know there's a lot of those areas that do have they're in what do you call them, transfer buildings or whatever you call them, trailers or whatever, but the community people have voted down the building of schools in those areas too, so that makes a difference too.
Question.
Representative Keller.
Do you have the information on MATSU that we have turned down bonds to build schools? I'm not up on that. I just wondered if you are, because we have in the past.
I don't know what the last couple years is.
That's right. And that's what's happening, is that we have this here hardcore wake-up call, you know, in the community. You know, if we're going to have a public school system, it isn't just buildings, I might add. When you expand at that rate, you know, finding getting the teachers, getting everything, the organization, the startup stuff, you know, it just costs money. You know, it's not just the buildings, and it's a real problem. You know, and we got to. I'd be really remiss not pointing out that out to you.
Okay, thank you, and Representative McKellar, that was the reason why the just for informational purposes. That was the reason why when the bill was constructed, it went back 2 years and had any increase between 2 years ago and 1 year ago, which is only taxed at 50%, to try and accommodate the when there is fast growth, that there would be something there. I do want to remind everybody that this does not directly affect the millage that is charged to a school district, I mean charged on a home or a business. The Kenai Peninsula has a sales tax, which is 100% dedicated to education. So this is the method of calculation based on valuation in the community, but it's not a mandated way that the contribution is assessed or is offset at the school district. So the communities can raise that money any way they want. This is not a direct tax. It's the millage rate based on assessed valuation is simply how things are calculated. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I'm just a little bit confused. Now, in the city of Juneau, I believe we've participated at 4 mills, which I believe is the maximum local contribution. So would this lower that contribution to 2.7 mills, thus adding state money to the local school budget? Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Munoz. It would treat all districts across the state at the same mill rate. Now, if you look down on the sheet there prepared by School Finance that lists all the boroughs and where they their millage rates, I think you'll see that
Juneau is not 4.
Juneau started out at 4.
Okay.
And every district started out at 4, but any growth since 1999 only counted 50% of the valuation.
Okay.
So everybody's growth in their assessed valuation since 1999 was only counted at 50%. So if you grew a fair amount since 1999, it means the millage rate is times a much less valuation than if you didn't grow. That's why some place like Craig that has not increased its valuation is still paying 4 mills on its entire 100% of its valuation, whereas some place like Nenana or St. Mary's must have had a seafood plant come in or some other increase to their tax base. They're only paying 2.7 mills. Mm-hmm. And so what we're having is those that are stable and or not growing are having to contribute a much higher proportion of the basic need than are those that have grown.
Okay.
And so and my district, just for clarification, my district, Kenai Peninsula Borough, is at 3 mills. So we're much less than 4 mills, too. So we've got, a borough that is now paying almost a full mill less than Dillingham, which is 3.7 mills, or the Bristol Bay Borough, which is paying a much higher proportion of the school cost. Representative okay. Mooney.
But that's a choice, isn't it?
No.
No, it's not. Okay. Could you explain that?
Yes. Representative Munoz, we have the basic need, which is what's calculated in the formula as this is what will be supplied, and then the amount that's required for a local contribution was originally 4 mills times your assessed valuation. What's your ability to pay? And you don't have to pay it by charging a mill rate, but that's the way you figure out how much it is. And then what happened was in 2000 the law was changed, and originally the bill had a look back that was a rolling look back the way we have it in this bill currently. And at the very end of the process, I believe it was on the Senate floor, there was an amendment to say instead of a rolling look back and valuation, we'll just set a year. And it was right at the end of session. Anyway, the amendment passed, and that's how we got that. That was not contained in the full discussion throughout the process of the bill going through the process in the House and the Senate. It was an amendment on the floor, which is perfectly proper. I'm not meaning it's improper, but I want to make sure that everybody understands that this was not the consideration that went through the committee process either. And I think this unintended consequence perhaps came because it was an element that came in at late in the process. And so what this is doing is just trying to make sure that we have state funding for education so that we can address the dollars into the base student allocation, into vocational technical. We're where we're addressing our dollars. So that's the intent. And Representative Keller, and
if it's going to be our position, this needs to be equitable across the state. I was wondering, do we have information what the unorganized borough impact aid, what the equivalent would be there? And should we consider making a requirement for local payment in those areas? You know, you talk about the community raising funds through sales tax or whatever, you know, but maybe we're the operating school board for the unorganized district. Maybe we ought to consider putting in a levy for property taxes for schools that is, makes it equitable.
Mr. Chairman, on that.
Representative Edmond.
Well, respectfully, maybe we ought to put the MATSU on diesel, too. I mean, it's a huge, huge difference to have natural gas heat your schools. And when you talk about stretching education dollars, I can tell you, and if you want the numbers, Representative Keller, I'll produce them. Huge cost savings.
And can I respond?
I want to make sure that we're not getting onto the cost differential. This is, we're on to, and we can talk about those things and everything, but we'll get into a huge debate if we're not talking about the issue at hand. You know, I'll let you respond, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to bring the department up to answer the question so that we all have information. So can we?
I just wanted to say that, Representative Edgman, you make my point. I mean, our struggle is with the growth. You know, your struggle is with the cost of diesel fuel. You know, and actually what Representative Seaton said, you know, is right to the point. I mean, we don't want to get into that. You know, that's why, you know, that's, so, anyway, yeah.
Mr. Jeans, would you come forward? I think Representative Keller had a question, and just to rephrase the question and see if I have it right, Representative
sure.
Keller. And that was, can you let us know how the REAs are treated and what the local contribution, or how there's any local contribution for in comparison?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans, Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. The regional education attendance areas don't have a required local contribution based on property values. Their required local contribution is through the form of the impact aid contribution. So the impact aid is in lieu of property taxes paid by the federal government for people that reside on federal lands that are non-taxable. So to Representative Keller, I would consider the impact aid the local contribution in the REAAs. Now, some REAs have more federal lands than others, and so therefore they're going to have a larger impact aid contribution that counts as their local contribution than others, which is the same with municipalities. Some municipalities have a larger tax base than others. Those that have a larger tax base are required to contribute more to support education. Those with a smaller tax base would contribute less. But the change that's before you today is to levy a uniformity on the mill levy in the required local effort. And as Representative Seaton pointed out, it's what's within the basic need. As many of you remember, when we go through the foundation program, we calculate need, which is the adjusted ADM times base student allocation. Once we have the need, we determine who's going to pay. And there's three components: required local contribution, which right now, as you can see from the schedule that you looked at earlier, ranges from 4 mils to 2.7 mils on the real and personal property values today. The other component is the impact aid, and then whatever's left over is your state aid. What this bill does is it levels the required local contribution from whatever value you're at today down to 2.7 across the board. So everybody would be at 2.7 mils. It doesn't increase the amount of money that you're receiving through the foundation program. It simply shifts it from who's paying, local versus state.
And Mr. Jeans, when you say it doesn't increase the amount, you're talking about the amount of money to a school district?
Mr. Chairman, the amount of money to a school district through the funding formula.
Okay, thank you. And Reverend Wilson, and then Keller.
And so although most, many schools, this will amount is less, some of them stay the same, but the impact aid from the REAAs, that doesn't affect that at all. They still have to give all that impact aid.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the regional education attendance areas are required to contribute 90% of the impact aid that they receive.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keller.
Yeah, on the same lines, the REAAs, do we have a property evaluation so we can make some comparisons of how that impact aid stacks up to the 2.7 that you're going to, you know, that we're considering here?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we do not have property values in the unorganized areas. The closest that I can come to that is per pupil valuation on the impact aid compared to required local effort. And quite frankly, I've looked at that in the past, and you end up with a number of REAs at the top of the scale that are contributing more money on a per student basis through impact aid than many of our municipalities. But you also have some REAs at the very bottom as well that aren't contributing very much, mainly because they don't have people living on federal lands. So that the range varies considerably.
Follow-up, Representative Keller.
Follow-up is just a point. The point, again, is if our goal is uniformity, we have a lot more to look at than what we're looking at.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Is the impact aid based on economic activity on federal lands?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, no. It's based on the fact that the land is non-taxable. It has nothing to do with economic activity.
Okay. And Mr. Jeans, you had said on people living on federal land that is non-taxable, you're just meaning because it's a... because it's federal land, so that we as a state don't tax it. Is that what you mean?
Mr. Chairman, the impact aid is for lands that are moved from state tax rolls due to some kind of federal intervention. So lands that were conveyed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act are non-taxable until some time that they develop those lands. If they're not developed, then they're non-taxable. But people live on those lands, so those people generate federal impact aid. Also, your military installations, where people live on base, those are non-taxable lands, and those people generate impact aid. So in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak, people are living on base. They're generating impact aid because they're not living in taxable homes.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Thank you.
I'd like to move House Bill 350, Version A.
Object.
We have objection. Discussion, Representative Keller. Okay, we'll call the roll. And this was with individual recommendations attached, fiscal note.
With individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Keller.
No.
Representative Book.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Chair Steeton.
Yes.
I have 6 yeas, 1 nay.
With vote of 6 yeas, 1 nay, House Bill 350 with individual recommendations attached fiscal note and moved from committee. We will now take up House Bill 413. And do we have someone from... my office.
Good morning. My
Good
name
morning.
Is Would Katie you're... Kester, and I work for Representative Seaton. House Bill 413 restructures the funding formula for the Alaska Challenge Youth Academy. The committee has previously heard overviews from the Alaska Challenge Youth Academy and how successful of a program it is for high school dropouts. Basically, they have two semesters a year where they did a lot of special measures for this particular group of the population, and they also follow their students a year after they graduate from the program. So these elements of Alaska Military Youth Academy make it a more expensive residential school than some. However, the traditional funding formula that has been used, 7 times the base student allocation, is not a very accurate funding formula for the actual cost of the program. So with the help of the Director of School Finance, our good friend Eddie Jeans, he came up with a number in statute that would reflect the per pupil amount that the Academy needs to do business, and that's $11,990. And that's approximately a $300 difference than what they would be receiving with the 7 times BSA. So that was just as close as Eddie could get it, and I think he did a pretty good job with that number. And so basically the legislation before you changes the 7 times BSA to the figure of 11,990 times enrollment, and that would include the residential and non-residential students in that multiplier.
Gabe, thank you. And are there questions for the presenter of the bill? Representative Munoz.
In the future, as the BSA is adjusted, would that affect this as well, or would this figure be stuck in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, this figure would be in statute. The legislature would have to change it.
Reverend Gardner, question?
Well, it seems to me that in other places we're attempting to avoid doing that. We want something that has a flexibility that ebbs and flows with some, so we don't have to come back and change statute every time there's a major cost of living change or funding change. Maybe, can you?
Representative Gardner.
Can you tell us, Katie, how this figure, $11,990, came from?
Of course. This figure came by taking 7 times the base student allocation for fiscal year 2011 and dividing it by the number of pupils. And then it was, so it's the almost the exact same amount as they would be receiving. Eddie just changed the formula, took the 7 times BSA, took that dollar amount, said, okay, what's that mean for each student? That means $11,990 for each student.
I have a question.
Rip them and you.
If it's so close, why is the statute necessary?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the changes in the BSA are often reflective of different needs, and the issue is that those increases, which would be so every time the legislature increases the BSA at $100, that's a $700 per pupil increase, and that those increases aren't really reflective of the actual increases in providing the service to those kids. So by putting a fixed number in statute, it makes it more reflective of the actual services that are received, and also it still maintains it within the formula so that there's still automatic funding for that that department, and it wouldn't have to go through a review like other residential boarding schools do. So it's the compromise that was achieved.
Okay. And we'll have both the Youth Academy representatives and the or DMBA and the department up here if there's really specific questions. But basically, Representative Munoz, the question that has arisen, and this arose a couple years ago as one of the identified issues during the legislative funding task force, was that we had been and are increasing the base student allocation, and a lot of that increase was to take over the PERS and TERS funding. And when you have a multiple of the base student allocation and you have a large increase in the base student allocation for PERS and TERS, you multiply that times 7, but you're not, you don't have 7 times the impact. And so the formula just doesn't work well. There's additionally, there's a large proportion of federal funding for this program. So this is the state proportion to match. Although it's not a 50-50, it's, I mean, there's more federal funding than that for this program. And it's a, you know, very effective program, but there's trying to figure out some way that it would still be maintained in the Department of Education instead of putting it into DMVA, which was, you know, the initial response was, well, but all of a sudden when you're looking for GF sitting in another department outside of education, it would raise red flags and be something that would have to be individually considered at each budget, whereas this maintains it in the Department of Education.
I see.
And the further calculations, like I say, we'll get Eddie up for that. Are there any other questions on the committee bill? Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pardon me. I want to just ask if it's appropriate to find out how many times the year where we have had requests for readjustments to the funding, and then I'm going to ask the same question of the other people.
Through the chair, Representative Book, the I believe the institution was established in 2002, so we haven't had the opportunity to adjust it. The 7 times BSA was the number that legislators decided was adequate at that time in 2002 to fund the program. So here we are 8 years out looking at if that needs modification.
Thank you.
Representative Book.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the committee's carrier of the bill? Okay, thank you. So we will go to public testimony, and come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I'd like to say to the committee members that this is a priority for us, and we do support this bill. This is a great compromise. But to answer Representative Book's question, the Youth Academy program has been in the state of Alaska since 1996. This formula was created, the current formula that's on the books, the 7 times the BSA, was created with the help of Mr. Jeans in 2002. There was a need then to look at funding to reach the next level, if you will, of cadet graduation. Previously, there was, you know, 40 to 50 cadets graduated per class. With that funding formula increase, we got up to about 100 cadets graduated per class. The unfortunate side effect of that is that we did start to receive a lot of money. And as you look from 2002 until today, the BSA has gone up about $2,500 per student. And we've gotten 7 times that. So we've certainly graduated more students per class, which has been great. But at the same time, as the chairman pointed out, this has been an issue as we go through our budget subcommittees and we talk about how the legislature appropriates funds and what is the true need for the Youth Academy. The $11,990 per cadet helped resident plus non-resident really freezes that number. And I actually believe that that's a good thing. We should be able to articulate when we need more money, and I believe if we need more money, you'll support us, and we'll get more money. At this point, having a freeze is appropriate because we have received enough money in the past. We haven't had to ask for any. We just automatically got it. And as the chairman pointed out, other schools, the reason why the BSA was increased was for TERS costs to cover some of that unfunded liability. We, in turn, in the department, decided, well, we should use some of that money to cover our PERS costs. So we've used it to help out and follow the intent of the legislature, but we get enough money per cadet right now to address their needs. And now we need to look on the federal side as well. And we can, the federal program has certain benchmarks. If you graduate X amount of students, you get X amount of federal funding. So we're looking to get that next step in student graduation, which means we'd get more federal funding. And as we expand the program, we can get more federal money. And it's a good fit the way it is right now. And the reason why your Alaska Military Youth Academy is one of the best in the country is because of the state contribution. And it's significant. And we certainly appreciate it. We don't need more. We're good right now, and we'd certainly like to hold on to this money for a while and let it sit for 5 years maybe, and then we'll come and ask for more. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Boot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell us how many times between 96 and 02 you've come to the legislature and asked for amended request for funding?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I can't specifically. I can tell you that it's my understanding that we did not ask for more money until we realized that we couldn't reach that next step of getting more cadets through the program without a significant change.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for Deputy Commissioner? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Jeans, would you come forward? We're going to have you wear a pad.
Still waiting for my lazy boy up here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance. You've had lots of discussion about this bill. What it does is it removes the direct link to the base student allocation and places a per student amount in statute. And as Deputy Commissioner Pierre pointed out, when they're ready to seek additional funds, then it will be incumbent on them to come before the legislature and justify that request. Otherwise, it will lock the per student amount into law at the $11,990.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. How does the funding for the Youth Academy compare to other residential programs like Mount Edgecombe?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I would say it's pretty comparable. The Military Youth Academy has this component that our other residential programs don't currently have, and that's the tracking of the students for one additional year. So they do get that additional bump for that component of their program. But overall, I'd say it's pretty comparable.
And for clarification, are you talking about the total funding for the Youth Academy, or are you talking about the state funding for the Youth Academy?
I'm talking about the state funding. It's comparable to what we provide for Mount Edgecombe, Nenana, and Galena. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And do Nenana and Galena get the federal funding as well?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, no, they do not. The Nenana, Galena, and Mount Edgecombe. Well, let's just start with Nenana and Galena. They get their educational funding through the foundation program, and then a couple of years ago, the legislature passed the boarding home funding, so they get some residential funding separate from the instructional program. Mount Edgecombe's operated by the state. They get their instructional funding through the foundation program. Their residential component of their budget is within the Department of Education. We come and ask for that funding on an annual basis.
Representative Gardner and then Boot.
Yes, and I think we've heard this before, but refresh my mind. What's the rationale for doing the Military Academy, Challenge Academy, differently?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the Military Youth Academy is not part of a public school system. It's operated by the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And back in 2002, they approached the legislature and the department
to develop a funding formula that would support them similar to public schools, including those the residential facilities. And that's how we came up with the formula back in 2002. As you've already heard a number of times, we've had increases in the base student allocation that weren't that were basically targeted for specific reasons. The big increases came with the increases in the PERS, TERS, the retirement contribution. And actually, the TRS was going up at a rate much faster than the PERS. And so we had increases in the base student allocation to help districts offset that additional cost. The Military and Veterans Affairs employees are PERS employees. So their rate of contribution was going up at a smaller rate. And as the Deputy Commissioner pointed out, didn't necessarily equate to needing seven times the base student allocation every time we increased the base student allocation. So this has been a discussion for a number of years, how their funding is provided, whether or not it was appropriate that it be tied to the base student allocation. This is just one other way to provide that funding, and it's a little simpler.
Representative Boot. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The tracking mechanism that is used by the Alaska Military Youth Academy to track 12 months after graduation, in your opinion, is that a useful tool?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I would say it's a useful tool, yes.
Is that something that the legislature might consider, in your opinion, for future? One of the things that we've been trying to do is find out what happens to our students after graduation. So post-graduation, finding this out, this information is valuable. And we have a couple other institutions that we fund that do not do that. In the future, do you perhaps see that as an opportunity?
Through the chair, Representative Book, with the unique student identifier that we have in K-12 education, I think you're going to see a little more of tracking of students, especially within in-state institutions. So students going on to college, how well are they performing? We can, you know, start doing some trend analysis, that kind of. And that also reaches back to the pre-K programs. The pilot pre-K program, we have required all of those districts that are participating to enroll their students in the state student ID system, so we can track them as they move into public, into the K-12 system, to actually look and see if we're seeing benefits from providing that funding early on. So in short, yes, I think you're going to see more tracking of students on both ends.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Munoz. Well, is there any further discussion? Any other questions? We have to have, see if there's any public testimony yet. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 413? Is there anyone online? Seeing none, I will close public testimony on House Bill 13. Is there committee discussion? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Representative Munoz?
I'd like to move House Bill 413, Version A, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, please.
Is there any objection to moving House Bill 413 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note? Seeing none, House Bill 413 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note will move from committee. We now have before us House Bill 393.
We're not that high yet.
Not that high or that late. Let's see. Okay. Representative Keller, would you go ahead and present the bill?
Thank you, Chair Seaton and committee, for hearing this bill. What I'd like to do, with your permission, is to let my staff, Jim Pound, introduce the bill. And I'd like to do some backfilling on maybe a few comments and then open it up to whatever questions you might have.
That would be fine.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff Representative Keller. House Bill 393 is for charter schools, and over the years, this body has pretty conditionally supported and watched the success of the charter school program. But today, many of these critical learning institutions are housed in somewhat substandard buildings. If you look at the law, the way it's written right now, a charter school can be put in any building that's just left over from the school districts of a particular school district, or as long as it meets some safety requirements, it can be approved for charter school use. House Bill 393 is designed to resolve that problem, and not only today's charter schools, but for those in the future as well. The bill that we hope you'll move forward today will assist the department with its ability to seek federal grants. It'll do this in two ways. First of all, it'll end the restriction on the number of charter schools, and we know this program works well, so it's time to let it grow. HB 393 also provides for a supplemental charter school facilities program. And through a combination of federal and state grants, essentially the state applying to the federal government for the funds, charter schools will be able to apply for those grants from the state to be applied primarily to brick and mortar. The next 5 years, the money will be appropriated by the legislature to be used in construction, leases, or major maintenance. The state does have an investment in this. At the time of 2015, the program will end. The results, however, will continue with charter schools in new and much better facilities. We have supported charter schools over the years in the legislature. HB 393 is the next step in assuring that the charter school program continues and expands in the state. We urge your support and be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Cowan. Could you show me in the bill where the limit on the number of charter schools is removed?
Section 1. I don't have the bill. I'm sorry, I had to turn over to it. Section 1 starts on actually line 6, where you can see the deleted language. State Board of Education. Mr. Chair. I apologize.
Okay. All right. And then
Representative Munoz.
And then on the percentage of funding allowances for federal funding, is it the intent then that the local district would pick up the balance? Because generally the charter school funding would not allow sufficient funds to pay for construction costs.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, essentially it's set up in a program where the state Board of Education or the State Department, whichever the case may be, applies to the federal government for grants. There is a federal grant program that is currently in place, and those funds come into the state. State, in turn, obviously, well, the local district or charter school, whichever the case may be, applies to the state for the grant funds.
Representative Munoz.
No, but what I'm saying is, according to this, the school would be eligible for a percentage of allowable costs, 90% the first year, 80% the second year, and so on.
Correct.
What entity would pick up the additional percentage to make the project viable?
Through the chair, I believe it comes through the local district.
The local
district. That's the intent of the law. If I could make a few comments on that.
Representative Keller.
Yes, the intent here. The policy choice in front of us is whether or not the legislature has a vested interest in getting facilities for charter schools. Bottom line, the cap I see is pretty insignificant. You know, that issue. I mean, I give you some history on it and everything, but I just don't expect that to be any kind of a problem. So what the Alaska Charter School Association has done is they came forward and they said, can we get a fund that is even a dollar a student? Because that's what it takes for us to be eligible for some of these federal grants. So we're only talking about $1,000 a year in actual program. So your question about the percentages, you know, how it's going to be applied and everything, that's all relative to whatever money comes in from the federal grants that are applied for, and plus whatever we put in, which in this case, like I say, is very minimal. The balance is to be picked up by the local district.
Okay. Can I ask one?
Representative Munoz.
And I guess that's the concern, that there would be no guarantee that the district pick up that additional cost. And sometimes, depending on where you're at in the state, there's good support for charter schools, and then in other areas, they tend to have a more of a difficult situation with their local boards. So I was wondering if you'd thought about that and maybe whether or not you should put intent language, participation language. I don't know. It's just something to think about.
Through the chair, Representative Mignos, I can't. There's a parallel bill in the Senate, and I can't speak for the. And that's from the Education Committee, and I can't speak for that committee. But as far as I'm concerned, that type of, you know, intent would be welcome. I would like to point out that charter schools are public schools. They have the option of bonding, you know, for construction projects just like a regular school. And like you say, that's very difficult in some districts. We've had charter schools in our district try it and fail. I expect we'll see it again in our district because charter schools are very successful, very well thought of in our community. And I wouldn't be surprised, but what we will see a rather traditional bond at some point, but that hasn't happened yet. So your suggestion, from my perspective, is welcome.
Representative Keller, I guess I'm trying to, looking on page 2, line 2, the department shall apply for the available federal funding and award the federal funding for not more than 5 years. And if we look down on, like, line 10, in the third year of a major construction project or this major project, there'd be 60% of the money would be for the allowable costs. And then we look down on lines 19 through 22, and it's saying a school district or REAA submits an application for a project, shall provide a participating share that is equal to the difference between the federal funding and the state aid provided under this. So under this, the school district is going to, at that year in year 3, be having 40% of the costs. The next year it'll have 60% of the costs. And these are costs that are going to come from the district for a construction project that, as I read it, the bypasses the vote of the people in the district. So a municipality is now going to be taking on a significant funding liability for building new schools, and the voters in the district never get to vote yes or no on whether they want to take that bonding authority on. But this says they shall be responsible for that contribution. And can you explain to me how that works?
Yeah, Chair Seaton, the understood there is assuming there's a construction project that goes on. And the link to the local voters is very, very real, better than the House of Representatives. Each school board member has less constituents. And so they do the approval or the not, you know, for the building. But the intent, and I, it's a good question, but I, my intent, and I'm the intent of the language as I read it, certainly does not obligate the district or the community or the borough to be paying for things at all. It's if the community decides to build a charter school, then this is the structure of the program and how it's going to be paid out. And in the intent, as I see it, is to leave the state harmless. In other words, to make sure it's understood to us that the state GF is not going to have to come up with the money here, you know, except by choice, of course, if we decide to advocate more and do more. But they're saying, hey, this is going to be picked up by the local district, that it, you know, and whatever money is available from the federal government. And as Representative Munoz has said, in every district it's very different. In our district, that'd be a very positive thing. You know, the local community would participate, have a partial participation in the building of some of these charter schools. We've done it already. I mean, so we have a really nice facility over in Palmer.
Well, and I understand the intent, and I'm not talking about the intent, but if you look at lines 19 through 23, and we can get the district guys up, or the state board up here later, but it says specifically that a school district or REAA will provide a participating share that's equal to the difference between the federal and the state funding provided, and therefore, we are saying that the school district is going to be 100% liable for whichever year you're in, for the difference between, in the third year, 60% of the costs, they're going to be liable for the 40%, or if you go down to the fifth year, they're going to be liable for 80% of the costs, and you're and this is a mechanism for the school district doing that and circumventing the vote of the people, because the vote of the people never comes into this application process. And I'm not saying this is the intention, but as I read the way the bill is structured, I want to make sure that that's not an unintended consequence of what we're doing. So, Representative Keller.
Yeah, I'm going to let my staff here reply, but I want to make one point very clear. This is for charter schools. They operate on a contract with the school district. They're public schools. You know, it's very different than a regular public school facility. That's why you don't see any public school facilities in the state. So, they exist in the good graces of the district is what I'm trying to say. So if they don't have a good relationship with the district and the community, you're not going to see a building. This is the way the nature of charter schools in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, essentially what the intent is here is to get them going.
I want to make sure that everyone understands I am not talking about the intention. I'm just reading the bill that we've got before us. It may need some amendments, and I'm just pointing out that what we're saying here is the district will be liable for that building. I guess the question is, does someone other than the district going to own this facility? I mean, charter schools have been traditionally a public school that's owned by the district.
That's right.
If this goes forward, it says the department shall make the application, and the school district shall be liable for the difference between the federal funding and the cost of the project. And, that can be significant amounts it would be nice to have new and good schools and everything else. I just want to make sure that we have the language right to accomplish what you want to accomplish without having an unintended consequence.
Just a quick response is that, of course, the community would be liable for the debt that it takes on, in the school like that. If they agree to build a school, that's way, not much different. And there's, like I might add that
Representative Keller, what I'm trying to figure out is, under the structure of this bill, who agrees to build the school? Because there's no vote of the municipality for a bond issue in here. There's a school district, the district itself, not with a vote of the municipality that's going to own the facility. The school district says we want to make an application. It says the department shall. It has to make the application for those federal funds for that building. And as I see this next section, and I want you to take a look at this and see if it, I may be wrong in my analysis, but it looks like that we have the district is in liable for those funds, but the district, the building is going to be owned by the municipality, and so that's where it's going to come.
Yeah, Chair Seaton, I appreciate the question, and we will look at it close and come up with a better, more definitive answer. My knee jerk again is that it just wouldn't be a concern. But
okay, thank you. And Representative Munoz.
Thank you. What if a federal grant covers 100% of the cost? So, I say that because I think this has a limiting factor to it when you set certain percentages. Because it could be that there's enough money federally to cover a certain maintenance project or.
Yeah, Representative Munoz, through the chair. As I see it, this program is a statewide program. So if one charter school was fortunate enough to get 100% coverage, I would assume that would just be more money to be distributed when it's applied for from a district that doesn't have that option. So that's the way I read it. But.
Rep, Follow-up, Representative Munoz, and then Representative Gardner.
To capture Representative Seaton's concern, you might want to insert pursuant to local support somewhere in the paragraph that deals with local participation.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On page 2, I guess line 4, it says, well, backing up a little bit, the department shall apply for available federal funding and award federal funding made available under the grant program established under A of this section for not more than 5 years for approved projects for charter school facilities. What would be the mechanism for approving those? Simply that they've applied and gotten the funding? Is that the entire approval process?
Through the chair, Representative Garner, the approved projects would be a local decision. However, whatever REAA or whatever local school district determines are the approval requirements for a charter school. The state doesn't normally establish the rules for charter schools.
Okay, so if a charter school is approved by the local district, there would be an automatic application for funding for a building for it?
Through the chair, there's no requirement for an automatic application for the district, for the department to apply. It's strictly a voluntary. It's up to the district whether they want to apply for this. It has nothing to do with, we're not forcing the district to apply for this.
Okay, so.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So in any district where there are charter schools, what is the mechanism by which the local community, the members of the charter school family, if you will, or the district determines which charter schools should be applying for the funding? For which schools should the districts apply for the funding?
Representative Garner, through the chair, there is no rules as far as what the local district wants to do, as far as who gets the money, so to speak. I mean, there would be, I'm sure, in the grant process, and I'm certainly not a grant writer, but I would assume that they would say, you know, Joe's Charter School for hamburgers, you know, would be the charter school that we want to spend the money on, or for what. I'm being very facetious here, and I apologize, but it's strictly up to the local district how and which charter schools they want to apply the money to.
Sorry, I'm just confused. I mean, some charter schools have buildings that they're satisfied with, some do not, but there has to be a mechanism to make that sort of decision, and that's what I don't understand where that is.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Gardner, through the chair. Typically, you know, the charter school operates based on a contract between the school, the charter school, what do they call it? The policy committee, the equivalent of the engaged parents and teachers and the school district. And when part of the question that comes up in the approval of a charter is facilities. You know, so some charters end up, you know, in pretty humble digs, you know, because they're willing to do that. In exchange for having control, you know, to help the educational process. So, you know, I mean, while there's no definitive answer to your question, what I perceive is that if you take a successful charter school that is doing well, you know, in a good relationship with the school district, good relationship with the community, that decision would be made between the policy committee for the charter school and the local school board. And the access of the voters to the school board is very good, you know. So it's a community, local decision on facilities.
Representative Munoz.
Well, and I've been through this process forming a charter school, and it's a very stringent process, very difficult to get a charter approved, and it is a contract between the school and the district. And it also has to go before the State Board of Education. And facilities is a provision of that contract. But under the information that you provided, the federal information, the awards are not limited by percentages of the project. And I'm wondering, why are you limiting the granting of those awards through that language, with that language.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I hate to admit this, but my question exactly, I did not write the language. It is a language that came, that I'm trying to parallel with the Senate side. And, and to carry on that, I have another question, and that is, why is it that $1,000 a year can come up with a fiscal note that is $150,000? Into perpetuity, and it must have something to do with the definition of this program by the department. So I think probably that would be more appropriate to ask the department just what they think is intended in this program.
Okay, and if I could just have another follow-up. And just to share the experience that we had here in Juneau, and they continue to have, that the facilities was paid for with the base student allocation, the money that followed those students to that school. So it's very difficult, you know, when you're paying for teachers and curriculum and everything else, that then you have to pay for your facility out of your base student allocation. So I really support this legislation. I think you're on the right track, but I do think there's some opportunities to make it even better. So thank you.
And Representative Keller, or your staff, on page 2, line 21, there was a question we heard earlier about the approval, who approves these projects, and it says, you know, a project for funding under the section that is approved for funding by the department. So it appears that the designation under this legislation of which charter school are going to get funding are decided by the department. Is that what I'm seeing in this legislation?
That, Representative Seaton, that's a very good question, and I would like to get the input from the department in order to answer that. The way I read it was that the decision that the department is making is where to distribute the funds in the program to. Not that they're approving or disapproving a construction project. It's whether or not they are approving or not approving, you know, sending the money to the district. That's what I see that.
Okay, and after we get the department, we'll be able to maybe ask a few more questions on that. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, line 30, it says the amount that the state shall allocate, an amount that is not less than $1 for each pupil enrolled in the charter school. Is that put in there just because you need that to get the federal grant?
Thank you for that question, Representative Wilson. That's exactly what it is. Eligibility requires that the local school district has a specific statute that establishes a charter school facility program, and that's why we're here. The Alaska Charter School Association determined that, you know, they are not eligible for federal funds because we have nothing in statute that sets up this program. So that's the intent of this bill, is to set up that program so that they can have access to federal funds that I understand are not available at the moment, but they come and go, and our current administration in D.C. is very supportive of charter schools, so we don't know where it's going to go.
Following up on that, you said the district, is this a requirement that the districts have a base student have at least a funding mechanism for charter schools? Are you saying that the state needs to set up a separate base student allocation formula for charter school students only? Which is it, the state is going to have to have a separate base student allocation, or is it in statute that the districts may have a separate allocation for charter school students within their districts?
As I understand it, Mr. Chair, it's the state, but it has nothing to do with the base student allocation. It has to do with whether or not we have in state statute a program that for assisting charter schools to get facilities. It does not specify that it has to be part of the BSA.
Well, Representative Keller, aren't we saying that we are going to establish a new per-student allocation specifically for every charter school student, which is basically a base student allocation? I mean, that could go up to $500 if or per student, or it could go to whatever, because it's a I mean, I presume that the $1 is a placeholder, and that the federal requirement was intended to have extra money per each student in a charter school. And I mean, I presume the $1 is not what the federal law requires. The federal law is probably trying to direct more money to per student in a charter school. Is that correct?
It's per student only in the sense of what we put in the program. It's not any kind of a guarantee for any student or any district based on their number of students. The money goes into a program for providing facilities to charter schools. And the dollar figure is not, sure, it's per student, but that's just a way of coming up with a number, and whether or not you're correct, it has anything to do with federal regs or not, I really don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, it might be from the Charter School Association.
And Representative Keller, I want you to understand I'm asking these questions, put the questions on the table. I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No.
Because I understand that this is companion legislation, but these are questions that we're going to need to deal with in the committee. So there's no intention to
as always, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your questions. I appreciate your insights into the subtleties of the laws, and they're welcome, and we want a good bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On a kind of a slightly different note, my understanding is that charter schools aren't always successful and they kind of fade away. They can't maintain the minimum student population, or maybe the concept doesn't ever catch on in a community. So if this bill were to pass, what would happen if a charter school was supposedly got this federal grant for funding, and partway through they just lose the student population and they go defunct, and the school district would be left with a building that they don't necessarily have a use for?
Thank you, Representative Gardner, through the chair. That would be part of the contract, that those facilities would belong to the school district. You know, so if a charter school failed, then the local school board has to decide what to do and how to disperse assets of the school.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there further questions for the sponsor at this time? I think the sponsor is going to remain with us. So.
if I may come up, I would like to rejoin the committee.
And let's go to public testimony. And before we get to online testimony, I want to get the department up so that we can understand the parameters of the program a little more.
Thank you.
Welcome. And it's you look different, Mr. James.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sam Keto III. I'm the school facilities engineer for the Department of Education and Early Development. And since this legislation appeared in the other body, we've done some research and can't say that it's conclusive, but I have learned quite a bit more about the program that this is intending to try and take advantage of. So what I'd like to do is back up a little and try and present my understanding of that program.
That would be helpful.
The federal legislation was actually passed several years ago and funded at a relatively small level, and two states applied and received funding for this program. Two states were Indiana and California. For the last few years, no funding for the program has existed. There's been a renewed interest with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for looking at what we can do, what the country can do to try and encourage development of facilities for charter schools. So this program got renewed interest. Part of the program is what happens is the states apply to the federal government for participation. And based on their competitive responses, they are granted funding if funding's available. And I have to assert that right now there is no funding available. The Congress has not appropriated any funding for the program. But under the competitive program, the states put in applications and demonstrate to the federal government that they have a facilities program, and then the federal government will step in and assist the states in kicking that facilities program off. One of the scoring criteria in the federal program or the grants is for the hold on a second. Is for the per student funding related to facilities, and that's the reason that the per student funding is in the legislation. But what the federal government looks for is how much involvement does the state give to student population in providing funding. So based on my conversations with other people in the department, it appears as though just putting a dollar in per student meets the letter of the federal requirement for having a per student allocation for facilities, but doesn't necessarily meet the intent, which means if we're competing with other states, that portion of our application would probably not score very well. It seems as though the way the program works is once you get accepted into the program, the federal government agrees to fund for that first year of the program once we've been accepted by the federal government at 90%. And then the next year they'll fund at 80%. And then the next year they'll fund at 60%, and the next year 40, and the next year 20, until what the federal government anticipates or believes is a state functioning facilities funding program is completely functional. So the intent is for the federal government to come in and help stair step a federal facilities or a facilities funding program for charter schools for each of the states. And again, we don't know if there's going to be funding coming down the pike for this program or not.
So before you go further, I just want a little explanation. So the intended purpose of the federal funds is to ramp up a state facilities program based on a per student cost, or as well as probably other factors. And so to be successful in a competitive grant program, you're going to probably have to, as the administration, come forward and show that the legislature and the administration is putting in place a program to fund separately charter schools, and that we need the federal funding to enable that program to of state funding of charter schools to be in place. Is that's
correct?
Can I?
Okay, and Representative Keller,
a follow-up on that question, just to clarify, to make sure I understand, are you saying that you believe that the federal intent is to ramp up a facilities program, a provision program for the states? I would bet, you know it better than I do. I have not read the details, but I was under the impression that the federal intent was to provide startup type costs and to, looking at the school themselves rather than ramping up a state program.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the information that I've been able to gather is for ramping up a state facilities funding program.
Thank you.
Proceed. I just wanted to get some clarity on that.
And before we get back into the state program, I think there were two other items that we had mentioned in Senate testimony or the other body's testimony, and we've got a little bit more information on that, and that is with regard to the competitive process where we apply. There are two components where we, as a state, have been applying for operating funds for charter schools for several years, and we've identified that we don't score very well. And those are areas that currently are not addressed in this legislation, and the department has some concern of whether or not those items can be implemented in the state effectively under the current way things are operating. And those items are that the charter schools themselves are administered under the local education agencies, and the competitive process requires that the charter schools have some kind of a statewide appeal body if the local education agency is responsible for establishing the charter schools, or that the charter schools are administered through a statewide program and not through the local education agencies.
Would you, again, go back and explain that a little bit more? I guess I'm hearing that the charter schools administered under the local district has been a reason for not getting operational money?
Correct. The federal government operational money. There is a federal charter school program for operational funding, and the state of Alaska has been applying for those funds. We don't score well enough to receive those funds, but we do make the application every year.
And so am I understanding that the federal government is trying to leverage through their qualifications state regulation and state operation of charter schools instead of local district operation of charter schools? Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Seaton, that's our understanding.
Okay. Thank you. And the other requirement was for if a local district turns down, let's say, an application by a charter school for facilities or for operation, a state body that would, or a state appeals process? Is that what you said?
Correct. Some kind of a statewide authorizing body that if a local education agency turns down a charter school, that they have an appeal process to appeal to.
Okay, and can you get us the synopsis or the those application criteria so that we can have those in our packet when we're considering this? Because I think there are things that are odds with a number of members of the committee, and so we'd like to see those actual provisions, those regulation provisions, or those criteria for the scoring criteria, because that would be helpful to us.
Yes,
if those are available. And I see Mr. Jean's coming forward just a moment, let me get this question answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Eddie Jean's, Director of School of Finance. What I want to make very clear is you're not going to see specific criteria outlined in their scoring rubric, but what we do have are the evaluators' comments. And in their comments, it's very clear that if you don't have a separate appeals board, that charter schools have an alternative route to approval, then we score very low. Also, I don't think it's necessarily state-operated charter schools, but that charter schools could operate independently like a local education agency instead of being operated through one of our existing public school districts. So those are two of the criteria that we know we get scored very low on any of our charter school applications with the federal government. The other one, which Sam was probably going to get to, was the cap. We have a cap of 60 in our state. Even though we're not even close to that on our applications, we get scored very low because we have one in law. So those are three areas that the federal government is pushing their agenda on charter schools through the application process for charter school funding.
Okay, and are those confidential, or can we get a copy of those so that we can understand?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we can provide the committee with copies of those.
Okay, that would be helpful. And Representative Keller,
if I might, there's some confusion. I think the criteria that we don't live up to in our charter school law has to do, with grading our law. It isn't directly related to facilities. And the reason I'm making that statement while you're there is that you can confirm or not. In other words, it is in an appeals process as it's related to whether or not a building is going to be being built. What it's saying is, what I think what is being told us here is that there other grants, operating grants, not facility grants, have been unavailable to the state of Alaska because we score low in general how they view a good charter school should be. So we're kind of mixing apples and oranges here. you know, and the appeals process is one that I would support for approval of a charter school. However, that is not a requirement for the facilities grant world. It may have an effect, you know, when decisions are made, but it's more of a broad sweeping thing than it is having to do with facilities. Correction or not?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, there is some overlap in the way the program works, is my understanding. We still have to apply competitively in order to be considered for this program. In order to apply competitively, we are understanding that we have to meet these criteria for the charter school operations.
Okay, and I think it would be helpful for us to get those evaluations so we can see how those are, even though, you know, they are not on this grant program, if it is under the charter school kind of emphasis or push that the federal government is giving, it would be good for us to understand what they're trying to push us into. And so that's not negative or positive, it's just right. Just getting information. And if there's two sides of that information, we want to see both sides of it. Representative Wilson.
And I probably will understand this better when we get the information so we can look at it. But this bill does take care of one of those by taking away from the cap. But we still have a long ways to go if any of the charter schools would even qualify, if I understand it right, because of the fact that we would have to change the whole concept in this state of charter schools, because now they are part of a school district, and evidently at the federal level they want them to be standalone institutions. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the understanding I have is not that they need to be separate, but they need to exercise financial independence, and they need to have their own ability to control their direction, which means that they would need to, they can still be operated within a local education agency, but they would need to have budget independence, and then they would also need to be able to have curriculum independence.
Which they have.
And yeah. Representative Munoz, and then Representative Keller.
Well, I think it goes further, too. I think there's some laws that where they look at independence in hiring, and you know, there's a whole range of issues that go into this topic. But anyway.
Mr. Jeans, do you want to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Eddie Jeans. I just want to caution the committee a little bit here, because you are not going to find these kinds of requirements in a federal regulation or in a federal law. That it's a policy issue that's being pushed upon the state through our application for federal grants for charter schools. So where you see these items that we're talking about right now is in the evaluator scoring sheet, where they score us really low because of components that they feel are lacking in our charter school legislation. So I just want to caution the committee a little bit, because the Senate asks us, go find the regulation, go find the law. It's not in a regulation, it's not in a law, but it's how they view our state law through the application process for federal grants.
It's kind of like race to the top and whether you will qualify, and everybody's changing their laws so that they can qualify for that application. Is that what you're talking
about? Mr. Chairman, it's a lot like race to the top, and if you're not on board with the federal standards, you're going to score very low on race to the top funds. Right. It's very similar.
Thank you. Representative Keller.
I have a question, but I would love to make a little comment here first. these issues in the evaluation of our charter schools started a long time before race to the top. And they've been well known, and the reason they're there is based on the success of the students that are engaged in the charter schools. You know, it's standards that have developed nationally that have nothing to do with the federal government. It has to do with the Charter School Association, you know, national and all that. And what yes, they are advocates for charter schools. Yes, they put their policies in front of us. Yes, we score very low and the quality of our charter school law by their standards. This is not a federal thing. They may be applying those things, but they didn't create them. They created them from the charter school, you know, advocacy movement. The question I have is that the $150,000 a year seems like a huge number for managing $1,000 a year appropriation. And I would like to understand what on earth is going on. And the reason I'm asking that is I want to know, is it the part of the language of the bill? Can we set it up in such a way that we can disperse that money a lot less expensively? What's going on there?
Before we go further, what $150,000 a year?
Thank you. I'm referring to the fiscal notes been provided with the bill. I'm looking at the one for SB 235, but...
Well, we don't have a fiscal note for this bill, do we? Do we have... I don't in my packet have a fiscal note. So you may be looking at a fiscal note for other legislation, but I don't think...
Ask the department why we do not have a fiscal note.
A virtual fiscal.
And
Chair Seaton, we have prepared a fiscal note. It is the same fiscal note as was prepared for the Senate bill.
Okay, and we don't have this at this time, but okay. Thank you, Ms. Representative Keller. I just wanted to, because we didn't
very
all
valid question.
We didn't have all the same information. So,
Chair Seaton,
while we're waiting for that fiscal note, let's you can go ahead and discuss, but I don't want to discuss the details of the fiscal note until everybody has it. But go ahead,
Chair. I was just going to provide a little bit of background, Chair Seaton, Representative Keller, members of the committee. When we prepare the fiscal note, what we look at is actually administering the funds for the project. And this kind of goes to the bill and to Representative Gardner's question. The way we see that this program would work, and the funding from the federal government would be based on the state's program being approved, which is not individual projects being approved. The state's program would need to take into consideration all of these items that we've discussed in this legislation, but it would also need to be a prioritization program. So right now we have a prioritization program for grants and for and a funding program for debt. If we're receiving applications from charter schools for facilities, we would need to establish a program for prioritizing those projects. I don't anticipate that we're going to receive enough funding from the federal government or from the state or from the school districts to be able to fund 100% of all the projects in any 1 year of the program. So I would anticipate that we would need to establish some kind of a prioritization program for application of charter school facilities projects.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Keller, did you want to follow up on that now that we have the fiscal note?
Thank you. The fiscal note in front of you, if you see the $301,000 there, that $1,000, as I understand it, is a capital expenditure that is being proposed by this legislation. The Charter School Association did not, I'm sure, I don't know, I haven't talked to them, but I would be surprised if they anticipated the $150,000 a year. And I understand your explanation, but I have some concern. You know, 1.5 employees seems like a large number, and I'd like to also put on the record that when the original charter school bill was passed, and I did not bring that information and I can get it for you, you'll see that there was a full-time equivalent approved at that time that goes on and on, that works in the Department of Education, EED, as an advocate and a coordinator for charter school things. And that person has had a lot more responsibilities than just charter schools over the years. And I think that this is a bit rich, compared to that. But only an audit would tell us that, But I'm just curious what your response would
through the chair, Representative Keller. When I looked at this legislation, and what I did is looked at the existing program we have for managing the debt projects, and we manage about $100+ million worth of debt and grant projects a year, and we've got four staff, one of them that actually works on preventative maintenance programs. So there's three of us that actually administer the grant program and the debt program for the state of Alaska. When I looked at this, I anticipated that based on the number of charter schools that we could reasonably expect, if a single charter school project was to construct a building, that cost would be in the neighborhood of $20 million. If we're going to have a program, I thought that program should be about a $20 million program. In order to administer that program, I discussed with people in the office what it took to administer programs that included federal funding in the past, and it took at least a full-time person to administer the program, plus the additional filing required. It seemed like it was the reporting requirements that we have to provide to the federal government were fairly excessive. I don't know what the program involves in this case, but I didn't want us to come up short where we would not have the staff to administer our own program, plus being able to administer a new grant program that is different than the existing grant program. And the reason that it does extend beyond is once the program terminates after 5 years, we still have those grants outstanding and active. So we'd need to have a wind-down or a wind-down process where those grants were closed out, and then those positions wouldn't be needed anymore. But they would be needed, I would anticipate, at least a year, possibly two, beyond the actual completion of the program.
Question?
Representative Keller.
Yeah, if could we get a department report on the the full-time person that has been functioning for charter schools, and I've known them over the years, and really appreciate them, but it just seems significant to me that whoever it is isn't here today. And I would like to know, and I know that in the past, or I was told in the past, that the charter school slot that was authorized was working on other things like social studies and whatever, and I'd just like to get an accounting from the department's perspective, you know, how that person has been functioning. I know we can't get into a lot of details on that, but I'm just very interested in whether or not. Part of my one following statement here, part of the reason I asked the question is that I was personally disappointed over the years because I was told that person would be there to advocate for charter schools, and I thought that would be the case, and instead I think it's been more a coordinating role and a oversight role and nothing to do that I could see with advocating for charter schools. But that was not the advocacy word I added. It was not part of the fiscal note that was provided from years ago.
And I do appreciate this. You know, we're talking about charter schools. We are here talking about establishing a new grant program for facility construction, lease, and major maintenance. And that's what this new grant program is going to establish the other criteria. So I appreciate that, and it does relate back to a fiscal note on how much effort is being done in the department, but I don't want any of us to start getting carried off into, you know, advocacy for charter school or particular charter school or this or that, and I'm not saying that's happening. No. But I want to make sure that we do stay on the grant program.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And I do not, my intent, you know, is probably to negotiate a bit on this fiscal note and hoping that we can, the committee can reason with the department and maybe come up with a little less of a fiscal impact here. And that's why I brought it up. It wasn't at all to go back and advocate.
No, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable question to figure out, you know, how much time do you folks work on your major maintenance list and the prioritization that takes place on the major maintenance list, because this is calling for a major maintenance priority list as I see it, a grants for major maintenance priority. This is calling for a priority list for how a program for how are you going to balance between different applications that come from many districts if the grant funding from the federal and state is not adequate, and also for leasing. And leasing is an element that we'll need to talk about, because that's kind of a different issue from the other two, which are currently in place, and this is a new one, I think, because I don't think we have a grant program for leasing, and that's where we'll also want to ask the department to clarify. But I think it's very legitimate, Representative Keller, to be asking what those are, as well as the other person that's doing charter schools, and whether their function could also be rolled into this function that's in the fiscal note that we have here now, or whether their position is totally different than this. So did you have a response to the question here, and then we go to Representative Wilson and Edgman.
Chair Seaton, we'll put together a report on the charter school position.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilson.
I'm looking at in our packet here, and there is an article written by Christopher Klicka, Esquire. But anyway, according to this article, homeschoolers may be objecting to this. And so I just kind of would like to be able to get some feedback from homeschoolers and what they feel about this. So I hope that someone's listening and will respond.
Okay, thank you. Representative Edgman.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple of points. One, the department is neutral on the bill. Is that correct? Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we don't have a position on this legislation right now.
As a follow-up, then,
Representative
Edgman. I'm hearing the discussion that there's at least somewhere down the line, whether the bill passes this session or not, there's some useful elements in the whole concept. Is that
through the chair, Representative Edgman? Basically, from the facilities perspective, whether the legislature decides to move forward with a charter school facilities program or not, I don't have a sense. But if the legislature does move forward with a charter school program, desire would be that it be a program that work effectively throughout the state, and I'd like to see a stable program. I'm a little concerned about having a program that only is effective for 5 years and is only contingent upon whether or not there's a federal program available to assist.
Lastly,
Mr. Chairman, in support of Representative Keller's comments, I think I'd like as well to get some more information on charter schools, and if there's 25 around the state, how many students are being served, as best we can know. We probably don't have the exact number, but just to get some sense on a basis of scale, what a program like this would mean in terms of introducing another category of schools into already competitive major maintenance dollars and construction dollars, and just, you know, what's the universe that we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the number of charter school students in the state at the current time is about 2,500, and they occupy approximately 24 independent facilities.
And Mr.
Excuse me, 2,500, what was that?
Students.
2,500 students in how many schools?
In 24 facilities.
Okay, thank you. But you have a synopsis report on charter schools that you could provide to us. We'd appreciate that synopsis report. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And if that synopsis report could also include schools that started and are no longer in existence, I'd be interested in knowing that.
Thank you.
We'll do what we can.
And we do have one person online to testify. I did want to clarify, though, from your perspectives as state facilities, the question I'd asked the sponsor earlier about the liability for the facilities, as you read the bill as we have it now, are the school districts going to own the facilities? Is it going to be currently like municipalities own the school districts, or...
Buildings.
Yeah, facilities. The school, this, whether the school districts, oh, sorry, own the facilities, or are we establishing a new classification, and also the liability for those percentages, those contributions that aren't made in the federal and state aid?
Chair Seaton, my understanding and the way I think we would look to operate is the way we do right now, which is that we require that a school district have adequate title interest in a facility before we provide funding for that facility, so that the district would either need to own the charter school would need to own it, or some mechanism thereabouts, which would assure that the public money that we put into a charter school facility is going into a facility that will best serve the public interest. That facility, if it's a leased facility, would not then, after 1 year, after we put millions of dollars into it, then go back to a private sector leaseor and the charter school moves on to someplace else. The other issue about liability is if we are using federal funding, I'm not sure, but in the past, when districts have used federal funding, they actually agree to grant assurances, and in those grant assurances, facilities are required to be operated for the public's interest for a certain period of time after federal funds have been included in those. I would have a concern that if we built a charter school facility and that facility was no longer used, that facility would end up either having to be used by the district or having to be maintained by the district until the grant assurance expires. We have an experience up in one of the interior school districts where they received federal impact aid to build a new school in a community. The community's population dropped and those students are no longer in school, but that school district is required to keep that facility serviceable until the grant assurance expires.
And can you tell us what the duration of the grant assurances are, and if you don't have that on top of your head, you can do it with the report.
Chair Seaton, in my past experience, the grant assurances were 20 years.
20 years. Okay. If you would provide that to us with the report that you're doing. So I'm kind of at odds here. I'm hearing that the district is going to own something, but at least in my district, the district does not own the facilities. The municipality owns the facilities. The bond holders, not of the district, but of the borough, actually bond for this. And now I'm hearing in here that it's going to be the school district and not the municipality.
Chair Seaton, we actually asked that the school district receive adequate title interest, and that title interest can be a facility that's owned by a municipality. There just has to be an agreement between the municipality and a district that facility is used as a school. We consider ownership by the municipality as adequate title interest.
Okay, and so following up on that, this grant program, as perceived, does this allow for the construction of a school and the liability obligation of the school district or the borough without a bond vote or some vote of the people for accepting the liability on that? And does this violate the requirements for those obligations to go before the voters in a general obligation bond?
Chair Seaton, I'm not sure if it does or not. I do believe that by applying to the department for a charter school facility, the district is obligating themselves to that future expense. But my understanding is, and what I would anticipate is, through a regulation process, we would make that application have the support of the local Board of Education. Pretty much the way we do now, where the Board of Education approves the six-year plan for our grant program, the Board of Education would have to acknowledge that they're applying for charter school funding. We would be very clear in the application what the potential district liability would be in regard to that program.
I understand that, but if the facilities are going to be owned by the borough, the municipality, does this, and I'm not meaning that this is the intention of it, but does this allow for the school district then to make application? And once they make application to you, you're required by you shall apply for the grants and you shall do the priorities. These obligations are then undertaken without a vote of the municipality. The school board's one thing, but the municipality, the municipal voters, it seems like the construction of the way it is would be taking an obligation without the approval of the voters. And have you looked at that, and has that come up in other discussions? Is that the case or not?
Chair Seaton and I have not looked at that in particular. I'm not really exactly sure how I would go about trying to approach that, but I can take a
okay,
look
well,
at it.
Okay, well, I think we need an AG opinion or ledge legal or something, and I see our ledge legal staff here as well, but I would like you to make sure that we clarify this. I know that it's not the intention of the sponsor of this bill to do that. I want to make sure that we don't have an unintended consequence of having that be the process. Because often the school boards put bonds up because they want them. And sometimes if they get turned down, it means, I mean, if they apply, and obviously a application for or putting a bond issue is an application, and as I see this, their application would kick off several shalls on the department and the obligation there. And I presume the sponsor are wanting to make sure that we don't have that take place.
Yeah,
Representative.
Thank you. I'm grateful that you're raising the question, and you know, at least get it on the record. If not, rewrite, you know, do some rewrite to get it fixed. I really do appreciate it. If I could ask another question.
Yes.
Just a clarification question on the $1,000 a year, and there's 2,500 students that are in charter schools, and I think you picked the number 40% of the 2,500 students that would be participating. I assume that is the 40% is the number of schools that would be affected by those, or the students that would be affected by those, that you think that you're anticipating would go for a grant from this program?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that was my estimate based on nothing better than my own intuition that we would anticipate that 40% of the students, whatever number of schools that would end up being, would be participating in that program in each one of the given years.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. I confess that part of the reason for asking the question is I just wanted to highlight the fact that the advocates for this bill is a pretty modest request, you know, and that it's only $1 a student for the students that are affected, you know, and so, you know, they were thinking in terms of $1,000 a year. So I just wanted to make that.
Thank you. We do have one person online. Let's go to public testimony. Kiki Abrahamson, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Good morning. Would you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
My name is Kiki Abrahamson. I live at 65561 Outback Avenue in Anchor Point. I am the lead teacher at Fireweed Academy Charter School in Homer, Alaska. I'm a former president of the Alaska Charter School Association, and geez, I really miss you guys. It's been wonderful listening to this conversation, and I kind of wish I was down there in Juneau again over my spring break. But I'm here more to answer any questions you have. I think, as I've taken notes here, there's a lot of information that I have. I think there's only been 3 charter schools closed in the state over the 14 years that charter schools have been operating. I personally, I don't think that there will be 40% of schools applying for these funds, because many charter schools are already in facilities and situations where they they are working out agreements with their school districts. I know that charter schools in Nome and Bethel and Fairbanks are all set. Most of the schools in the Kenai Peninsula School District are set because we've already worked out arrangements with existing facilities in our districts. I think it's mostly Anchorage and Mat-Su where there aren't facilities available, and those schools and APC boards would be the ones that would be applying for these funds if it was available. I can also provide you with a, there was a one-page deal out that evaluated charter school law in the states, and that kind of outlined all the criteria that Mr. Keto was discussing about charter schools scoring low on these federal grant applications. And Alaska has always been kind of at the bottom of the barrel as far as the scoring for effective charter schools. I disagree that, and I'm not very politically astute, but I disagree that the feds are pushing their agenda with this the grant program and the scoring process. I think that what they're doing is trying to, and maybe this is pushing their agenda, but our charter school law in Alaska scores so low that it's not friendly for charter schools. So you have charter schools all over the state that are looking for facilities, which is a problem with charter schools all over the United States. But I think by improving our law, it isn't necessarily pushing a federal agenda, but more becoming more friendly, because after all, charter schools, you know, are expected to meet or exceed the test scores and the academic progress of all the other schools in their district. Yet, we've got the handicap of not, you know, as we discussed last year, not having the funding and then not having the access to facilities. So I'll find that information and email it to you, but if you have any other questions for me, I'm happy to respond. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Abrahamson, I don't think that we have that one pager, so if you wouldn't mind sending that to us as well, or at least I'm not finding which one you're talking about in our packet. So I appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions? Seeing none, you and the Charter Association and everyone else, of course, we'd appreciate you submitting any information you can to clarify any of the issues that we've been raising today. That's all I had signed up to testify on this bill at this time, so we will hold this over and look for some additional information, and we will be adjourned at 10:02.